mangroves, swamps, and deep forests in Malaysia live some of the largest bats in the world. Flying foxes. Flying foxes feed on different parts of a tree, but one of their favorites is floral nectar. To get the nectar, the bats crawl over the flowers before pushing their faces deep into each one. This causes pollen to cover their bodies and faces. These pollen grains get transferred when the flying fox moves between trees. Through bat pollination, flowers develop into mature fruits that produce healthier seeds. Just by feeding, flying foxes help pollinate flowers, produce roots, and even plant trees. Large seeds are often carried away, but when feeding on fruits with small seeds, flying foxes swallow the seeds whole. These seeds are then excreted elsewhere, sometimes while the bats are flying over open spaces. With the seeds far from the parent tree, they have a better chance of surviving and reforesting new areas. But despite being important, flying foxes are often killed. In fact, the most serious threat to flying foxes is hunting and killing by humans. For fun, for food, and out of ignorance. Even though fruit bats may feed on fruits planted by humans, there are many ways around this issue. Killing is not the solution. Without bats, farmers might be forced to invest time, money, and labor in hand pollination, thus suffering even bigger losses. Local people say they no longer see flying foxes in many areas where these bats were once found. We need to understand that when our flying foxes disappear, our forests and fruits could disappear too. But if we stop killing them, hopefully one day we can see flying foxes fill the evening skies like they used to.
Hello. Chat! Welcome to the 44th podcast. Sorry about that. Welcome to the 44th podcast. We're talking about flying foxes today. Low volume. How about now? Better? Good? Cool. We are already at $75.77. We got a $50 donation right before the podcast started. Thank you for that. I'm clouded with $3, DD with $5, and KZ with $17.77. Thank you very much. I'm super excited. I don't know anything about flying foxes, and those are my favorite podcasts, and I don't know anything about the species. I did some research beforehand. They're very, very cool. One of the largest bats, and their wingspan is about 6 feet, which is the equivalent of a turkey vulture. Some bald eagles are about that size, so big time. Progress is not a typo, no. So that is the name of the organization that we're donating to today. That website is in Indonesian, so most of you probably will not understand that, but we'll make sure to have Susan tell you about it. she was really excited about donating to this organization because it was created by a former student and partner community member. They're a registered NGO, and $1K is the equivalent to 2 months' salary for their entire patrol team. So, big time for that organization. These donations are gonna be huge for them. So, thank you so much for the donations that you've already made. That's where your donations are going today. We are speaking with Susan Tseng, who is a very accomplished woman. I found her on Twitter. I like finding a lot of my guests on Twitter. And I was scrolling through and I saw that she studies flying foxes. And I was like, oh, that's so interesting. And she was willing to come relatively last minute. So thank you. Thank you to Susan. She is a nerd of all things flying fox in Southeast Asia. She's part of the IUCN Bat Specialist Group. She has experience in wildlife trafficking consultancy. Cindy with the $10, thank you so much. She currently conducts her research as an associate at the American Museum of Natural History and the National Museum of the Philippines. She is also a research collaborator in the Division of Mammals at the National Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian Institution, and she spends time at the National Museum of Natural History and the National Zoological Park. She also is a CEO and founder of her own scientific consultancy called Biodiversitas Global, which provides technical expertise on a variety of topics, natural resource management, development, capacity building. And she has worked in... She was a AAAS Science and Technology Policy Fellowship in the branch of counter wildlife trafficking strategy and partnerships in the Division of Management Authority at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services headquarters in Washington, D.C. So, she is a very accomplished woman. She's done lots of things. Today, we're specifically going to talk to her about her research in the biogeography and evolution of Southeast Asian flying foxes. Deer and Esmond, thank you. Take a breath. I know, lots of titles, huh? It's like, I really had to read straight off her website to say those correctly. So we're going to talk to her specifically about flying foxes, about what their conservation challenges are. We may talk about other bat species as well. We'll see if we get there. Crowway, thank you for the 15. We'll also maybe ask her about her experience in the wildlife trafficking, anti-wildlife trafficking work. Thank you, Tombo. If you have questions for Susan, you can ask those questions by doing hashtag ask followed by your question, like Max just did. Great example. It will be sent to a doc for me so I can read them out to Susan during our conversation. There is also a quiz at the end of the podcast. We now have a quiz command. Warbird, thank you for the $20. Big time. Everybody, Peepo Pog for Loch Ness. He made an addition to the Conservation Cast website where it walks you through setting up the quiz step by step for those of you who don't know how to use it or didn't know how to set it up, whatever. So you can do command quiz to get to that. Oh my god. Dito. Dito's got money all of a sudden. Conch with the 23-28. Dito with $420. G2 with $4.23. Thank you. Okay. The way that the quiz works, I will explain at the end of the podcast, but all you need to know is that it's 5 questions. It's based off of the conversation that I have with Susan today, and if you win, you get a gifted sub either to my channel, someone else's channel, or you can ask me to donate an additional $5 to our organization today. If you want to find out more about the org, you can do command org, but I did mention earlier the website is in Indonesian, so you may be better off allowing Susan to explain it to you during the podcast. But if you want to see Susan's socials, you can go to command guest. It'll take you to her Twitter. She does a really great job on there. So, yes, I think that's... Oh, Koopa Steve with the 77. Hairy birds. Okay. Koopa, thank you for the $77. And Dito with $420. I don't know who that is, but thank you so much. That's nuts. $645 already. That is huge for the organization that we're raising the money for. Thank you for your donations. If you're not able to donate, I'm still glad you're here. Let's learn about flying foxes, shall we? Is there anything that I'm missing? I don't think so. I don't think so. Okay, if you have any questions, hashtag ask followed by your question. I'll make sure to get to some of them today. Not all of them, but I'll do my best. Boobs with the five. Thank you. Give me a minute. I am going to call Susan and tell her that we have $650 raised. Jeez. This podcast is nuts.
Hi.
Hi.
All Thanks right. for having me on.
Of course. Yeah, let me see if this is working. Chat, let me know if the audio is not... Oh, a little loud. Okay. Do this. How about now? I don't know why this isn't... Where is... This. All right, cool. Chat, how's the audio? We'll see. We'll see as we go. Susan, thank you so much for coming on today.
Yeah, no problem.
We just did a little bit of an introduction. I wasn't able to tell them all that much about the organization because I couldn't read the website, but I told them that you would tell them more about it and that we'd talk a little bit about your research and about flying foxes. We've raised $650.28 so far.
Wow.
Like, before you came on. So... if you could introduce yourself and then tell us a little bit about progress, that would be wonderful.
Hi, I am Dr. Susan Sang. I am a research associate at the American Museum of Natural History in New York and also at the National Museum of the Philippines. And I collaborate with folks at the Smithsonian Institution, National Museum of Natural History and the National Zoological Park. My primary interest was actually in the evolution and biogeography of flying foxes. So biogeography is like why animals are there where they are in space and time. Mm-hmm. And because I studied these animals that are really rare, what happened was it turns out, you know, I need to do a lot of conservation work because otherwise in, you know, 30 years, I'm not going to have anything to study. And also these bats are just really important to a lot of these island systems that I work in. So my major field sites are in Indonesia and the Philippines, and, you know, both of them are hugely archipelagic countries. And because of that, we actually need these bats so that they can bring seeds and bring, you know, the genetics of different trees across different islands to each other. And that used to be an area that people would used to think only like birds or bees or, you know, butterflies have to deal with, like these pollination and seed dispersal type things. Mm-hmm. But bats actually have a really, really big role in that in Southeast Asia. And a lot of the economically important crops and even the ecologically important crops really depend on these bats. So because of that, I ended up going with my Indonesian student who now works with WCS Indonesia, Sarah. And she said to me, hey, I want to work with you on flying foxes, and you have this interest in this huge bushmeat issue that's in Sulawesi, and I'm originally from there, so, like, let's go and work on this together. So mm-hmm. I said, sure. And from that, we were able to work with local communities to really build this, you know, community-based conservation effort to patrol the roost in order to protect it from hunting, mm-hmm. which is where a lot of the problems come from. And that way you also just don't have the extraction of individuals that leads to the market. It just stops it in the origin, and that protects those species better. So because of that, we got National Geographic to fund us a couple of years ago. And it was, the start date was actually delayed because it was the same time as that giant earthquake in Indonesia.
Right.
So we were delayed by a couple months, but then, you know, we started, things were going really well. And as a result of that, the community has now really taken ownership over this project. And so they decided to start their own little NGO, Progress, which is, it, in Indonesia, you have to get registered to be like an official NGO. They call it a yayasan. And it's now like super official, and they work with government partners. We have signed agreements with the local community chiefs, and they also are committed to doing this work. And we started with these flying foxes, and now slowly we are expanding to also do work on green turtles, because these are overlapping in their ecosystems. You know, a lot of the flying foxes that we work in are in mangroves and these really coastal areas that are really threatened by climate change and by human development. And because of that, we also run into a lot of things related to turtles. Like, I've run into hunters of turtles even once when we were going to go visit a new roost for the flying foxes even.
Oh, geez.
So this is like a really major, major issue. And because people don't really know that flying foxes are illegal to hunt, they will tell us stuff that they wouldn't tell you about other animals that they know are definitely protected.
Right.
So you can find out a lot of information about like where the hunters are and where the trade routes are. And people, you know, they actually understand and really do care about the environment once you actually tell them about how everything is connected. But it's just that some of these places are so remote that they don't have access to science education and access to resources that allow them to really learn about how all of these things in nature that they can't see are actually connected to their own lives. And so a lot of what we do is not just for the bats, but also to work with the community to do things like more sustainable farming, or getting them to take like fish guts to use it as fertilizer for their crops instead of using like commercialized fertilizer, mm-hmm. and things like that, that help basically make them more green. And they actually wanted to do that for a very long time, but they just didn't know how to do it. And so we're helping them in a way that they want to also, that happens to help our flying foxes also.
Yeah. That's very cool. With the turtles and flying foxes, is the hunting primarily for consumption, or is it like trophy hunting, or what?
So it's mostly for consumption. In Indonesia, the one place that really eats them is in this one province in North Sulawesi. So that's in the central part of Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a very strange history. They basically were like the super, super Christian part of Indonesia when the Dutch were still their colonial overlords. And so because of that, they have churches every like two blocks. And one way that they distinguish themselves from Muslims is actually by eating wild meat, like bush meat, because it's not halal. And so Muslims wouldn't usually eat them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why you see this huge market in Northern Sulawesi, not just for bats, but for things like snakes, feral dogs, forest rats,
mm-hmm.
Cats, like basically primates, like anything that you can find that's like bush meat instead of like regular meat, they will eat it. And because bats are really, you know, plentiful, if you find a colony of them, you can catch thousands of them at one time.
Yeah.
Then they look like they are fine as a colony and as a species. But when you really look at it, they've depleted the populations in the areas near them. And they're slowly going to other islands and other provinces to take those bats and importing them to there. So it's becoming a problem that's now spreading outwards, even though it was really concentrated to that area. In other parts of Indonesia, like in Papua New Guinea, like the Papua New Guinea is, you know, an island that's in half, and there's an Indonesian side to Papua. And they actually also eat them, but because the population there is much lower and has to do with a general sustenance instead of this like special kind of meat, they are not really hunting them at a level that is like completely unsustainable. And so that kind of issue is a little bit easier to solve also, because it clearly is a sustenance issue where you can just, you know, teach people how to farm chickens and it basically replace it.
Right.
And then in Western Indonesia, we have people who eat bats because they believe it's like a medicinal cure for something. So the reasoning that they tell me is, well, the bats eat fruits. And so we eat the bats that eat the fruits. They're really healthy. And so we become really healthy.
Uh-huh.
And so they think that eating that will help them have a, you know, more cleaner diet. But also they believe that if you eat the liver, which in the culture that believes this, that's the center of the body instead of the heart, they believe that will cure asthma. And so there are a lot of older people that have used this as medicine for a lot of younger people, and a lot of younger people don't really care and don't believe it, but it's still sold at some traditional markets for, you know, like, I guess like $10 for a single bat, and all they want is the liver. So yeah, and it's even cheaper in places where they eat them like commonly and not just as like a medicinal item. And so people are really eating them really quickly in a way that's completely unsustainable. Bats are not like rodents, even though people like to call them rats with wings. Bats are only able to have one pup per year because the energy that they spend in terms of parental care and like flying doesn't allow them just to have a ton of offspring.
Right.
So because of that, you know, if you kill an adult bat, that's killing like generations of bats afterwards that can't be replaced.
And what age do they reach sexual maturity?
Usually I've seen the bats that are more successful are probably like 1 or 2 years old.
Oh, geez.
They reach adulthood probably around like 1 or 2. It kind of varies between species, which I don't want to generalize.
Mm-hmm.
But with a lot of the ones that I work with, it takes a couple years. And then in the first year or two that they try to start mating, I don't really think that those males are as successful as some of the other males, especially because in some of the more colonial species, there's a harem system. And so you have larger males that are more capable of holding the harem and fighting off other males. Be more successful, and so the younger males are not able to compete as easily. But that, like I said, you know, it varies across systems because there are also flying fox species where it's like monogamous couples where they just like to hang out with each other and that's it.
Right.
But yeah, it's there's 65 species of them, which for a group that is, you know, this old world fruit bat group is actually fairly large for the family it's in. It might not be a lot compared to other bats. Like in the U.S., we have the vesper bats, Myotis, and they have hundreds of species that are like global,
mm-hmm.
but flying foxes are only in Southeast Asia and in Oceania and like a little bit off the Australian coast. And there's a couple of them in Ryukyu Islands in Japan. And then there's like a couple of them in the Western Indian Ocean islands, like the Seychelles, and then they make it to Madagascar, but it's all these islands. And so, you know, the pattern is always like, when you're on an island, it's not really the best news for you right now when oceans are rising, especially because they depend on these mangroves, and mangroves are, you know, in ocean. And so as that water rises, they're going to lose these roosts that are very safe, and they're not going to have anywhere to go because the closer that they get to people, people don't like them because they think that they're noisy, or they think that they smell bad or something, or some people hunt them. And so it creates a suboptimal environment for them that makes it really stressful for them. And that's what leads to a lot of these conflict issues with humans,
mm-hmm.
Which can go anywhere from things like agricultural raiding, where they blame bats for it, even though birds might be the ones that are eating their fruits, mm-hmm. or the fruits couldn't be sold anyway because they're overly ripe. Or things like with viral shedding, when an animal is more stressed, it's more likely to have an immune system that can't handle it. And so like they might be shedding more virus, and that can potentially jump to people or to other intermediate hosts like domestic animals that mm-hmm. people are releasing into forests in order to have it basically eat free food in the forest instead of like feeding them. So there's a lot of these types of things that can happen because of the fact that we're forcing them out of their natural habitats also.
Okay.
And so it's a major issue in a lot of places where you do see that contact. But again, like for the most part, the most important direct exploitation issue that we work on is hunting. Mm-hmm. Because for us in our area, that's the most pressing issue.
Is the hunting primarily done through shooting, or do they use nets, or are there other methods?
So in the area we work in, the people who hunt them, I've seen them use nets, and I've seen them use, because they know where the roost is, what they do is they put these really tall poles, and there's a fishing line that goes across the top. And on the fishing line, there's these hooks that come down. And when the bats emerge at dusk, their wings get hooked and they get stuck on it. And then the guy, the hunter, will go out and check it in the morning. And the bat is probably still like alive, actually, usually then, and just stuck on the hook. And they'll take the bat, you know, blunt force trauma, and then it's dead. In some cases, they actually bring it live to the market. Some people want live bats, not just dead bats.
Mm-hmm.
In some other places, we do see people using, they're not really like guns. They're more like homemade guns. They make these things out of rattan. I've seen people hunt elephants with them also, if you make a strong enough one.
Mm-hmm.
So there are people that do use guns, but it's not really as common as some of the other methods.
Okay.
Mostly because it, you know, it's really hard to get a gun in generally anywhere that's not America, really.
Yeah, imagine that. Raptor with $10.83. Sheesh tipped $20 and Smile tipped $2. So we're at $683.44. You mentioned in our DMs on Twitter that $1,000 is the equivalent to 2 months' salary for the entire patrol team.
Yeah, so it's probably more than 2 months. It's probably like a few months.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so Indonesia, the rupiah has a hugely deflated value. So when I was a graduate student 10 years ago, about 10,000 Indonesian rupiah is one US dollar. And so it was already like, wow, that's a really big number. Yeah. And you can get a lot with 10,000. So then a couple of years after that, when I was living in Indonesia for the year during my Fulbright fellowship, it was 12,000 Indonesian rupiah to one American dollar.
Oh my gosh.
And so I could buy my lunch for 12,000 Indonesian rupiah.
Uh-huh.
And I like, it's just, things are really cheap. And I was living in like a university town. So things were like probably a little bit cheaper than usual, but it's still really, really cheap. And so our patrol staff, which consists of a lot of the community members, and also there are people that volunteer from a local nature club that actually have said like they want to help us do patrols and they want to be committed to this effort. And so we want to pay them so that, you know, we pay for their work on this because they're really, really helping out a lot. And they're helping out also with logistics organization for us to like go onto these islands and also monitor the bats and capture the bats when we once in a while want to just, you know, see how they're doing. So for the staff, it's about six patrol people, one office person, and one manager, and one community manager. And they all help with patrolling and cooking and all the other stuff that you have to do when you go to the field.
Mm-hmm.
And in, if you look at how American dollars translates to how much you can buy in Indonesia, it is actually like 2 or 3 months of their salary.
Wow.
And most of that money also probably ends up going to pay a boatman who has to drive the boat to the island and like go around it. And that's actually, the boat rental is probably the most expensive part, not even the salary.
Okay, good to know, chat. So Silky with $14.93, so almost at $700, which is making a big difference for this organization. So thank you for your donations.
Thank you.
We've gotten lots of questions about flying foxes that I would like to ask, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure.
Neon asked, why are they called flying foxes?
So a lot of people misunderstood that they were bats for a very long time, actually.
They do, yeah, they have that. I'll pull
their face, their face looks kind of dog-like. So I once showed a photo to my mom, and she looked at it, and she was like, did you get a new dog? And I was like, no, that's the bat that I studied, because you asked me to show you a picture. And she's like, oh, shit. And so, yeah, they do look very doggish, which isn't really surprising to me anyway, because there is a lot of people who are only familiar with the insect bats, just because they live in Europe or in the United States, where that's mostly what you see. Or in South America, even, they have only these smaller bats. And so a comparison is that the bats you'll see in North America, like the biggest species, will at most be like the smaller than your fist, maybe.
Right.
But the bats that I study, the smallest ones are about this long in body size, and the biggest ones are like this long in body size. And the biggest species, which is Turopus vampiris, the large flying fox, which is native to Indonesia, to the Philippines, so all over peninsular Southeast Asia also, they have a wingspan that is 2 meters-ish, a little under 2 meters. So that's like about 6 feet. And that's a wingspan that is larger than I am tall, because I'm only 5'2". These bats only weigh something like 1 to 2 kilos. And so they're very efficient in terms of their body size. They're very slim. There's a lot of them that also vary, though. When they only live on singular islands, they have these, you know, big wings, but instead they have more like giant pectoral muscles, and it lets them kind of control their wings better, because the wings are slightly different shapes to maneuver in forest environments. And you'll see that with a lot of flying species, where you get what's called an aspect ratio, and that's basically the length compared to the width of the wing.
Uh-huh.
And that shape will change depending on how you fly. And because a lot of these larger bats depend on flight that is extremely, you know, long distance, then you'll see them have these longer wings, whereas the ones that are in forest, you'll see have these tighter wings that are closer.
Right.
So yeah, the flying comes from that. Bats are the only true flying mammal. Any other mammal with the word flying in front of it is actually gliding, and, you know, they're lying to you. And so, you know, so bats are super unique because of that. And because they can fly, it allows them to do things like, oh, well, now we have the sky open and we can go to all these other places that other animals can't. So this is just, you know, free real estate. And so, you know, that's why there's a lot of species of them.
I said it in the intro, but for reference, a turkey vulture has about a 6-foot wingspan. So if you've seen, I think you guys have seen me with turkey vultures, just for like a size comparison. That's huge.
Yeah,
so that's
big.
Very cool. So Dixie asked, What's the difference between bats and flying foxes? You just talked about a couple differences between North American bats and flying foxes.
Yeah, so flying foxes are a genus. So a genus is a group of species, and the genus itself is pretty variable in terms of where they live, but like in general, they all kind of look like these flying dogs. But once you step back into other bats, there are, you know, 200 species in the family that that genus belongs to. And then overall of bats, there's over 1,400 species. And I know personally, a lot of my colleagues and friends are still describing some. So there's probably more than 1,450 species at least. And that makes it the second most common mammal on the earth, only overtaken by rodents. So 20% of all mammals, one in every five mammal is a bat.
Wow.
Or the species, not abundance wise. So that's a lot of species. And because of that, they're very variable. And so bats as a whole are really different. And flying foxes are unique in that they don't echolocate. They actually are, you know, very focused on using smell and sight. And that's why you see them have these dog-like faces with, you know, big eyes and twitchy noses. And if you look at a lot of these other bats that you would generally encounter in Europe or in the United States or in other temperate areas, or like in your house, like if they lived in your attic, they are going to be really small and they will have very large ears and they will have really scrunched little faces where you can barely see the eyes. And generally they will be echolocating bats. And that's because most bats actually rely on echolocation. It's only the 200 or so species in the old world fruit bat family that that flying foxes belong to that don't echolocate. And that they actually are using cues from plants that are like smell. Like if you look at most of the plants that are targeted towards bats, instead of being very colorful, they're usually white. And then they have this really strong odor and they will only open, some of them even only open at night so that only bats can go and pollinate them. And one of the studies that my student did for her master's thesis was actually looking at like, what is the most efficient pollinator of these durian flowers? And it's because people all usually assume that because they saw the bats going to the flower, that they were like destroying it. But when you actually look at it, the bats are the ones that are really pollinating them. The primates that come up to the flower will just pick the whole flower and eat it. Mm-hmm. Same thing for like these other mammals that are arboreal. And then like birds are the worst because they'll just poke a hole at the bottom and just drink the flower nectar during the day. Like when it's not even open, and you're just like, what the hell? So these bats are really important because they got to stick their head in and get all that pollen and, you know, fly to another tree. And you do have a group in South America that is also pollinators and frugivores, but they are evolved from insectivores. And most of the bats that are in the world that you think of as a bat are insectivores. Mm-hmm. So they eat, you know, moths and they eat crop pests. They eat all kinds of stuff that is like mosquitoes, even in some cases. That is bad for us in some cases too, because we don't want to have dengue, for instance, in Southeast Asia. And so it's great to have bats around to eat all these mosquitoes. But you also see this huge diversity of diets in these other bats. But in flying foxes, they are only frugivorous or nectarivorous. And in some cases we've seen them like eat leaves, but you know, that's more like they need some fiber in their diet and not like a nutritional issue sometimes.
Okay. Lots of donations have come in here. Javi with $3, Mr. with $20, Danny with $5 with a question. I'll get to your question. Babyface with $10, Stretchy with $5, and Tom with $20. So we're at $761.50. Danny with his donation asks, do they have social systems, the flying foxes?
Yeah, so there are some of the species of flying foxes that live in giant colonies, and you see them in groups of anywhere from like 100 to like 20,000. So largest colony of flying foxes that we know of is in Subic Bay in the Philippines. And that's because Subic Bay was built on a Clark Airfield, and which used to be an American military base. And so nobody was allowed to go in there. And so the bats are like, oh, yay, trees that are tall that nobody can come in to do anything to. Yeah, and so they do have these huge colonies, and because of that, their structure, right? So in these colonies, like I said, in Australia, they've studied them where they know they have a LEC system where it's like a harem system and there are males of different hierarchies that get to mate with the females and are situated in space in a certain way that allows them to do that or not. In other cases where you don't have that colonial structure, you might not have these types of social systems exist. And it might just be a pair bond, or it might be the bats are solitary and they only come together to mate and then they leave again. But generally speaking, the social structure for many of these bats, because they are colonial, is in this kind of harem system. And we don't actually know if that's true for all of them because we don't have enough information on most of these bats. Like, I recently wrote a lot of the entries in for the Handbook of Mammals, which is this giant book that we use, the scientists use for looking at mammal descriptions. And a lot of the bats that I work on, the only information that we have about them is their original taxonomic description and where they're from, mm-hmm. and maybe what plant they were living in or found on, and that's it.
I see.
So we have like no idea what they do. And sometimes when I go out there, I'm like the first person to see that bat in 50 years, 60 years, 70 years, 100 years, even. Wow. So like these bats are not common in some spaces if they are solitary, and that's actually why it's really hard to study them. But the colonial ones are assumed to have very similar behaviors. And so in Australia, it's really easy to study them because they are in urban spaces, including in botanical gardens. And mm-hmm. so people can like sit there and like watch them and create studies that are more rigid in order to understand that system.
Mm-hmm. Danny, thank you for the question. That was a good question. Yeah, with $20, thank you for that. And Trev with $10, thank you. Okay, so we have a couple variations on the question. Max asked, is there any species of bat that actually feeds on human blood, or is that simply a myth? So we've gotten a few blood questions.
Okay, so there are no bats that want to drink your blood.
Okay.
Vampire bats, first of all, there's only like 3 species of them out of the 1,400. Uh-huh. It's like less than 1%, guys. So like, why are you afraid of them? And second of all, they're only in Central America and South America. Uh-huh. And generally speaking, they will feed on the blood of livestock, like big mammals that are, you know, ungulates of that sort. Mm-hmm. So what they do is, and actually vampire bats are really cool in order to actually get this food. So first of all, that makes them one of the only mammals that count as a parasite because they're depending on not the meat of another creature, but something else from them.
That's
like really just weird and different. But also they have like, they have this way of walking where because they don't want to fly onto the host or off the animal they're feeding of to scare them, they like fold up their wings like this and they walk like this on the ground. Uh-huh. And then they do that. And then they get to the hind leg and then they just kind of shuffle up the hind leg of like a cow. And their teeth are so sharp that it cuts the cow, and then the cow doesn't even feel it because it's so sharp. And then they have in their saliva these anticoagulants, so the blood keeps flowing instead of clotting, and then they just lap it up like your cat drinking milk. And
that's
so these cuts are really, really small because vampire bats are like that big. And what's really interesting about them is that because blood is not just like a common resource that you find as just out in the environment very easily, a lot of vampire bats have social systems where they share blood with each other. Also, like if they can't find a meal. So one of my colleagues, Gerald Carter, he's at Ohio State University. He is like the expert on vampire bat social evolution. And some of the things that he's found are really cool because we don't know any other system that exists like that, where it's basically altruism, mm-hmm. But it's not in humans. And that's not really very common in nature. So if a vampire bat can't find a blood meal, they will like go up to another vampire bat and like tap them on the shoulder kind of, and be like, hey, I need some food. And uh-huh. then your friend will feed you. And a lot of what he's found actually shows that they form social networks, and they are obviously closer and rely more on the bats that they are closer with.
Wow.
And kin also. So it's not just like kin, but also like the bats that they meet in their original roost. And once they go somewhere else, even if only some of the bats came with them from that original roost, they will probably tap on their friends first to ask for food instead of like these new bats that they met, even if they do form a colony that's cohesive now. Uh-huh. So like there are very similar ways of thinking about how we act to how they act, which is like you feel less awkward about asking your friends for help mm-hmm. than like a stranger. And you know, for a lot of these systems, we didn't even know that that was the case, but for them it's really critical to their survival. And so we, you know, have people that are really interested in them. And like I don't think people should be afraid of vampire bats because they're really tiny. they're like that big.
Yeah.
They're really small. There used to be there's like a subfossil vampire bat that was found in Southern California, and they're like a little bit bigger, but not really by that much. Like that counts as like a big bat in South America, Central America, and North America. But like for me, that counts as like a small bat because I work on giant bats basically.
Yeah.
So I don't think people should be afraid of them. They also have these really cool sensors kind of in their heads that basically tell them like where the heat source is, and they kind of go towards them, and that's how they find animal to eat. So yeah, there's tons of really cool physiology related to vampire bats, and you're not going to encounter one to eat you. So like, don't worry about it.
Space asked a similar question. How does that transfer work when they're giving each other blood, when they have their blood?
Oh, they just basically lick it off each other. Like, it's really the same kind of licking thing because they don't have any other way to eat, right? So, because it's not like an insect where you just pop it in your mouth and you can chew. And so they're like lapping blood off from each other. If you go to a zoo, there are a lot of zoos that have vampire bats in colonies. You will see that the way that they feed them is they put like these trays of like blood, like kind of high-ish, and then the bats will just come and drink from that. That's actually pretty common with a lot of zoos. This is easier to take care of them that way.
Interesting. Okay. Those were a lot of fun things that I didn't know. KZ asked, what is your favorite thing about bats that people might not know? There must be so many.
Oh man, that's really hard. Every time somebody asks me that, that's really hard. So I'm just gonna say some random facts that I know that
Okay,
are probably people don't know.
perfect.
So for instance, one thing is for some bats, when they are in the mating season, if you imagine that the bat was human size, the testicles on the male would be the size of pumpkins.
Wow, that's impressive.
So that is like the size ratio for some of these males. Another thing that I really like is that because I'm originally from Hong Kong and I basically grew up with a very Southeast Asian kind of diet also. So I really like durian, and durian is this big spiky fruit that a lot of
Yes.
people don't like because they think it smells really bad. But a
Yes.
lot of us who grew up with it, it's really sweet, and there's actually a lot of varieties of them. Thailand has a whole billion-dollar industry where they make different kinds of durian and all kinds of moisture levels and sweetnesses and whatever. In Indonesia, because the bats are the ones that are pollinating them, I've actually found a lot of information out about the bat colonies from the local community that we didn't know about by buying durian, and we just will sit on their porch and eat with them. And then we'll just kind of like tell them about the bats while we're eating the durian, and they get really excited and they get to eat free durian. And so that's a great way to teach people about bats.
Oh, that's cool.
I guess another thing for me is also just like I think people don't realize how important they are to the health of the forest. And there's probably more stuff that we don't know about in terms of the health of a marine ecosystem that's connected to bats. So one of the major projects that I was supposed to start this year when I was allowed to fly, was actually looking at the deposits of microbes and nitrogen that come from bat feces, from flying fox feces, into these coral systems that are around them.
Oh,
That's
that's
because a
cool.
lot of these mangroves in Indonesia and in the Philippines, it's just the Pacific Ocean. It's not like in North America with the Atlantic, where you have a continental shelf. So it's just literally the coral reef is the Pacific Ocean. And so a lot of fish actually depend on the mangrove to be a nursery for them. And a lot of these fish are commercially important, ecologically important, and everything like that. And when the bats come back, they will poop and they will pee and they will, drop their little bits of seeds and stuff that they have in their mouths. Like they might drop it also, or anything of that sort. And so it goes into that marine system, and then it's a huge transfer of carbon and nitrogen from a inland source that would otherwise not be available to these marine animals. And they bring a lot of them because of the fact that they are in colonies of thousands of bats. And people have really started to pay attention to how much this might affect like marine life very recently, because they thought about how there are these giant rocks that boobies and seagulls will sit on, and they just poop all over them, and then it gets washed off into the ocean. And they're like, hey, that's like a really big source of nitrogen, which is a limiting resource in the ocean. And so I was kind of talking to this with somebody else, and I was like, I wonder if that's the case for how bats are, because that's actually something that would connect marine life to terrestrial life. And we don't really think of that a lot. Like a lot of people will kind of stay in their own fields of just marine work or just terrestrial work. And because the bats live in these spaces that are the borders of marine and terrestrial life, even though they're the flying ones, they are a really important link. And I think that there's a lot to be studied about that because we don't know a ton about it. And there are enough sites in the world where we do have healthy populations over coral reefs, where we can study that. Not a lot, but like enough that we could study that versus the ones where they used to have flying foxes and they still have a reef there, and versus the ones that are just reefs without flying foxes above them. And so we can create an experimental setup where we look at the diversity of the microbiome and the nitrogen in the water and all this other stuff in the coral. And that way we can understand more about how bats are connected to the rest of the world in a novel way.
That's so
So
cool.
yeah, so it's just stuff that we don't know. Like honestly, I think people seem to forget that when people say bats a lot, when they talk about like diseases or pathogens, they forget that usually that pathogen is like in one bat species, or it's originally from that, and it's not even directly from the bat species, it's like from something else. And because of that, you know, people end up thinking like, oh, all bats have this disease or whatever. And it's not really the case. A lot of bats have different diversities of viruses depending on where they live or what species they belong to or group they belong to or how they interact with each other. And I just think people don't realize that bats are not just the kinds of things that you find living in caves that are, you know, like little rats with wings kind of situation. The bats that I study live in giant trees. Mm-hmm. And then there's also bats that live in little tents. So they find like large fronds, and then the males will actually break the edge of them so that there's like a cover on the side, and then they will just live in this tent. And then there are bats that live in like rolled up leaves because they're so small, and they'll live in like little groups. And so if you look up the Honduran ghost bat, they're those little white puffball ones. Yes. They live in rolled leaves as groups of like five or six, right? So it's stuff like that where people don't realize that there's just bats like all over the place. And there's even a bat species that have like sucker pads on their wings that help them like attach to the side of stuff. So there's a lot of really weird evolutionary things that bats have done because of the fact that they don't have competition in the air and at night. And so they're really capable of doing all these things, but we don't know about them. And so we are afraid of them. But, you know, if we look at the fact that bats are evolutionarily built to be able to tolerate all these viruses and all these really difficult environments to live in, they are the key to how we can actually answer questions about, you know, what's going to happen with the next emerging infectious disease. Because if they have a way to tolerate it, that means that we probably can figure something out by studying them.
Yeah.
And we haven't really done that yet because people haven't historically spent as much time researching them.
Right. That's so cool. I would have never thought about that connection between the marine life. That's really interesting. SMK tip $20. Thank you. James with $5. Danza with $20. B Jork with $20. $40 actually. So $876.50. Thank you guys so much for those donations. We got an interesting question here from X Gramp said, why do bats sleep upside down?
It's actually easier for them. I don't have a good picture to show it in any sort of this, but when you look at the way that their feet are like this, it actually costs them no energy for how it hooks over a branch. Mm-hmm. And so that's actually the at rest position for them. And it just makes sense for them in terms of how they fly. Because when you take off in flight, for them, the way that they fly, it's different from how birds fly, and it's different how we think of flying. So a bird and an airplane fly in the same way. There's a stiff thing that comes out like this, and then there's some stuff that comes off it that helps you fly.
Right.
Bats don't have that. They have their hand is their wing with long fingers. And so they can make different shapes with their hands and their wings. And so to take off like that, you can't really do the push off in the same way. You have to do it slightly differently. So bats that I work on, they like swing like this on the branch, and then once they get enough momentum like this, they just like let go of their feet and take off. And so it helps them just take off easier and gather momentum. And since that is the rest position for their foot, well, it probably evolved into something that works better that way. Then that's, you know, just easier for them to hang upside down. And if you look at just like the motion also that they use to fly, it's pretty clear that the way that the body works, it's not just that they used to glide and then like eventually they just flap their wings and it works. The way that they fly is actually like pushing off. It's like when you do a push-up almost in one way, and then like you have to put your hands out and do the flying thing and then flap it. Mm-hmm. So there are motions physiologically that are very similar to ours when we think of like pushing off the ground instead of gliding, and that lead to flight because it's powered flight. It's something that you need from your body to be able to do, and you want to save as much energy as possible when you're not in flight. And so most of the time you actually will see bats in trees, they will climb them instead, or like they'll climb a branch instead for the flying foxes, is it's just less energetically costly to climb a tree branch to get to somewhere if you're already on a tree versus like flying off to somewhere. Because it just, flying costs so much energy in terms of like the number of steps that you have to do within your body to make it work. Mm-hmm. So yeah, having that foot thing is just, it's just energetically not costly. So it makes the most sense. And it's also good for momentum building.
That makes sense. Outcoming, thank you for the $50. Jeef with $10. So we're at, oh, we're so close. $936.50. Thank you, guys. All right, let's see if we can get a few more questions in here. We have a few questions about echolocation. Why they use echolocation, how it works. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
So I can give you a very, very simple overview because I'm not the expert on this kind of thing.
Okay.
So there are two types of echolocation. There's the kind that comes from your nose and there's the kind that comes from your throat. and they belong to two different major groups of bats. The ones that I work on obviously don't echolocate, but they're more closely related to one of those groups, and this different kind evolved in a different branch. So you can think of them as two major branches of bats. Mm-hmm. And generally how echolocation works is that it sends out a sound that comes from the throat. And then we actually know this now from some of the bats that we've studied, is that they use the downbeat of the wing to help push air out. Mm-hmm. And it helps like help the sound come out. So it actually saves them energetic, just any sort of energy to just do that at the same time to expel that sound. And that's so sound cool. Will hit something, and then once they hit something, it comes back, and they have these big ears that wiggle to hear things like that. Mm-hmm. And so they can figure out where something is in the dark by using echolocation. And since that is a major feature for how bats hunt, if you look at insect bats in North America and Europe, there's a lot of people that study how moths actually have created these anti-sonar ways to avoid bats. So moths are one of the major prey of a lot of bats, a lot of insect bats in the North America. And what they do is they have these really long genitalia and they wiggle like this. Uh-huh. And it basically forces a sound wave that is the reverse of that. It cancels out the bat thing. And so nothing happens. Like there's no bounce back, no echo for the bat to hear. And so they don't know where the moth is. And so then obviously, evolutionarily bats find like a slightly different frequency to try to track them. And so it becomes something that is pretty clearly like they are in an evolutionary arms race. With that echolocation though, that is often what people think about for like the only sounds that bats make. But a lot of bats also make a lot of sounds, when they're in social groups with each other and in the roost, that are just like these chittering sounds and like the squeaking and stuff like that. Like they have words basically that they say to each other, mm-hmm. right? Because that chittering means something to them. Mm-hmm. And so there are other forms of communication that they use that we can hear also. And they mean different things like, hey, where's my mom? Or like, hey, get off my back because I don't want to mate with you. Mm-hmm. So like there's just a lot of different ways for bats to communicate, but like echolocation, I think people only think of that as like the only thing that bats can do for sound.
Right.
I do think that there are a lot of complicated things about echolocation that are a little too technical. But I will say that generally speaking, it is something that is actually not that difficult to evolve, because of the fact that for cetaceans, for like dolphins and whales, they actually also echolocate, and they have the same genes, like the same family of genes that bats use to echolocate to evolve, that isn't the same also in cetaceans. So evolution, like whenever people are like, which came first, like echolocation or flying, mm-hmm. I'm always like, flying obviously it was more difficult and it came first, because it's just like there's no other way that they could have evolved in multiple times, versus like echolocation. Well, one group found one way to do it and one group found another way, but they also still turn on some of the same genes that will then lead to the echolocation happening. And so there's actually groups in the world in Queen Mary, London, and I think there's another university that I can't think of right now, that study like how the genomics of adaptation affect how bats are able to echolocate, and like there are ecologists that study it and how they echolocate in different environments. And that can vary a lot, right? So in places where you might have a very noisy stream, mm-hmm. then a bat might echolocate slightly differently from a bat that's echolocating in like the open air to hunt for something. Mm-hmm. So it's really variable, and it's a whole field unto itself because of that. Like people who study acoustics, that are like kind of in their own world.
Yeah.
Like, I don't bother with them sometimes. They're in their own world.
Crazy to think that it's that precise that they can use it for like aerial insectivores can use it like in the air. That blows my mind.
Yeah. And actually, the echolocation frequencies are so precise, there are what's called reference calls, and they are actually different enough between some bat species that they only recognize each other as the same species because of that. And so we define some species genetics, by morphology, but also by echolocation.
Wow, that's so crazy. Andrew tipped $50, thank you. Mate tipped $1. We're at $987.50. Thank you. Yeah, people are saying in chat, you said that you're no expert on that. That was plenty. That was so cool. Thank you so much. And lots with $50 got us to our 1K goal. So we're at $1,037.50. Thank you for the $50. I appreciate that. Okay, I think we have time for one more question. Crowway with $5. Actually, maybe instead of one more question, one of the things that I like to ask our guests is, if they're not if they're not researching bats, if they're not able to travel and get on the ground and do stuff like that, what can viewers do, typical viewers do, to support the conservation of bats? Or is there anything else that you want to share with us about bats that you feel like more people should know?
So if you are in the United States, one of the major issues with bats here is that they've lost caves to white nose syndrome. Millions of bats have died, like 96% to 99% of some of the species have died. And the caves still have this white nose fungus on them, so they can't return to some of these caves. And we encourage people to actually build bat houses or buy them from people. And they're not that expensive. They're something like $20 from Bat Conservation International's website. Or people just build them like by buying the wood from Home Depot. It's like a really slender mailbox. Mm-hmm. And you just need to put it somewhere not quite at your house. It's like somewhere kind of safe in your backyard that's dark and like snakes and squirrels can't get to it, like having it on a pole or something. Like that's actually a really helpful way in North America to help give bats a place to live right now. Mm-hmm. If you're not in North America, there are a lot of organizations that work with bats, but it's because it's very specialized, it's actually really difficult for there to be a lot of experts in some countries that are not as resource rich as the West. And, you know, a lot of bat scientists like struggle to find enough money to fund conservation efforts or to fund research. And so I would encourage you to actually reach out to a network. And if you are interested in where those places are, you can contact me because I'm also the principal investigator with three other people for what's called Global Bat Network. And that's our big like network of networks group that we actually just got a huge NSF grant for a couple days ago.
Wonderful. Congrats.
In order to like organize this thing. And the actual bat scientists work within these networks to build these bigger initiatives for conservation. And so donating to them or working with them to form community outreach activities is also really helpful. I think people don't realize that they have a lot of skills that scientists really value that we don't have, like people who are better at making videos or art or even mm-hmm. just advertising, or even how, you know, how you teach somebody who's not a bat scientist something. Those actually are skills that are really helpful to scientists because they're not trained in that way.
Yeah.
And if you offer that kind of help to somebody and say like, I really like bats and I know you need something like this, can I help you do it? Then usually they will say yes or no, or they'll point you to somebody who probably needs help with something. And there are international organizations like Bat Conservation International, Bat Conservation Trust, there's like several of them if you just look up like bat conservation NGOs. If you want to donate specifically to a flying fox group, there is what's called Lubee Bat Conservancy, L-U-B-E-E. And they are in Florida. They actually have a conservancy where they have flying foxes that they've bred and helped, you know, recuperate populations of. And they actually allow researchers to come and study them also, because we sometimes need to do physiological studies on bats that we can actually hold and monitor over time. So they are a really great group to work with, but they're a very small NGO, and so people don't realize that they exist sometimes, mm-hmm. but they are very instrumental to funding projects in the South Pacific and also in Southeast Asia, where these bats are native to. Nice. And another thing that people can really do that I think is really helpful is just convince at least one other person that bats are not dangerous and they're really cool.
Yeah.
Because one of the major blocks for us is actually that people are not receptive to hearing any facts about bats or mm-hmm. any news about bats if they are afraid of them.
Right.
And so breaking that barrier is actually really important, and having people who are not bat scientists that people think are biased tell other people that is actually really helpful.
Great. Thank you. So you guys being here, I hope some of you changed your minds about bats a little bit. That was a lot of really wonderful, interesting information. That was so cool. Susan, thank you so much. We got a couple more donations. We're at $1,055. So that's wonderful. Thank you guys for donating. Thank you guys for listening. I say it every podcast now, if you're not able to donate, like Susan just said at the end of her spiel there, was if you're here learning about it, you're making a positive difference too. So don't worry if you're not able to donate to the podcast. I appreciate you guys all being here and learning. And Susan, I appreciate you for teaching us. That was so cool. That was so interesting. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, thank you everybody for the donations and supporting our work.
Yeah, I will send you some more information about the analytics and stuff like that of the podcast after if you're interested, and I'll talk to you after then.
Thanks, bye.
Thank you so much, bye. Dude, she's sick, huh? She was good. That was sick. I feel like we need a whole... new pod or a whole other whole additional podcast on bats. There's so much to learn I didn't realize. She's crazy smart. There is so much information. I feel like I could talk to her for like 4 hours. Yeah. We could have a lot of conversations with Susan about bats. I never knew how little I knew about them. Same. I didn't know that much about bats either. That was wonderful. So we're at $1,055 for progress today. Thank you guys so much for those donations. Like we said it a couple times on this podcast, but those donations go it's Corey with $45, 1.1K. These donations go a really, really, really long way out in Indonesia. Like she said, it's like a few months' salary for their entire patrol team. So the donations today go a really long way. So thank you for that. We had a lot of really interesting facts here, and we have a quiz to do that we may need more questions for. Let's see. Isn't that the place where they have human-sized bats? Well, welcome to the podcast. You can go back in the VOD if you want to learn more about the bats, but we talked about that pretty much the whole time. So, thanks for being here. Anyway, so the way that the quiz works, it's 5 questions based on my conversation with Susan today. There are 20 seconds per question. You can do command quiz if you want to know how to set it up. Pretty easy, but you need to allow access to participate in the quiz so that I know it's your username if you win. Otherwise, it'll just show up as contestant number, whatever, how many digit numbers, and I won't know who you are, so that you can't win that way. The way that you win the quiz is by getting the most answers right the fastest. So you'll get points by answering the questions correctly and answering them quickly. I will read the questions before they show up on the screen. And yeah, I think that's it. I gotta type out a couple more questions here, but give me a few minutes. Do command quiz if you want to know how to set it up, if you don't know how. Ooh, look at this. I forgot to check this. Nice, Locke. I'll be back in a minute here. Hold on. And by a minute, I mean probably 3 minutes and 7 seconds. All right. Quiz time. Sorry, I had some technical difficulties. For some reason, it was telling me that I didn't have access to creating the quiz. So I sorted it. Now we're here. We're ready to go. Cool. Enable access, please. Yeah. 5 questions, 20 seconds a question. Who is going to win the quiz this week? Answer the questions correctly the fastest. Here we go. Oh, shoot. I just realized that I read the questions before, but I wrote, I think, 3 of them on my own. So hopefully I remember them, but I may not. The first question, though, is, the first question is, around what age do flying foxes what is up with the quiz extension lately? Like, what is this? Why is this? I thought that this happened because I was squad streaming. This extension is just broken. Oh, wait, no, it's working. Scoffed. Okay, I went live. What's up? At what age do flying foxes reach sexual maturity? Is the first question. Is it, or at, do they reach adulthood? Means sexual maturity. Is it at a month? Is it at 6 months? Is it at 3 years? Or is it 1 to 2 years? I think a lot of you got that one correct. It's 1 to 2 years. I said that before it was over. Sorry, I wasn't looking at the thing. 1 to 2 years is the correct answer. And that is tough for flying foxes because Susan said that they only produce one offspring a year also. So when you kill off a flying fox, it like ruins generations of flying foxes. 194 people got that correct. Well done. Who got it correct the fastest? Blizzy. Well done. Blizzy, and then Chase, and then Quick. Very nice. Very nice. Okay, the next question is, what organ are bats hunted for use in traditional medicine? Is it the heart? Is it the lungs? Is it the liver? Or is it the kidney? A kidney. Lots of easy claps in the chat. The correct answer is the liver. Bonus question. What specifically do they think that the liver can cure? Well done. Yeah, okay, cool. Oh, damn. Okay, maybe that should have been an actual question. Good job. Asthma. Yeah. The correct answer is liver. 206 people got that correct. Well done. Who got it correct the fastest? Pause, champ. Dennis. Croton, then Digital Cupcake, then contestant number 1068. I don't know how we could make it any more clear. Gwick is in the lead, followed by Hace, and then Blizzy. The next question, the last 3 were written by me, and I want to ensure that I have them in the correct order in my head. I don't think that I do. Here's what I think the next question is. What is the average wingspan of a flying fox? Nice. Is it 12 feet? Is it 6 feet? Is it 2 feet or is it 10 inches? What the heck is a feet? Okay. I understand some of you don't use feet, but we'll go ahead and each quiz, we will do it based on the units that we used with the guest on the podcast. The correct answer is 6 feet, which is the equivalent of a turkey vulture or a bald eagle. Who got it right? 205 people got that right. Well done. Who got it right the fastest? Chat? Who was it? It was Cinny, apparently. Nope. Digital Cupcake. Then Crass, then Cinny. Cinny, very close. Gwick is still in the lead, followed by Haste, and then Cinny, and then Riz. Pod, space. Nice. Okay, next question, I think, is what is a common misconception that people have about vampire bats? Is a common misconception that they can be altruistic with other vampire bats? Is it that they want to suck human blood? Is it that they are small bats, or is it that they drink livestock blood?
You good?
The correct answer is a common misconception about vampire bats is that they want to suck human blood. What is she doing? Too easy. 282 people got that correct. Well done. Has Haste pulled ahead? Has Cinny pulled ahead? Has Dagger pulled ahead? X got that one the fastest, then Charlister, then Ron John, then doesn't matter. Gwick is still in the lead, and then Riz, and then Betty. Haste really fell off. That's okay. Okay, the last question is... The last question is, how many species of bats are there globally? Is it 50 species? Is it 16 species? Is it 1,450 species? Or is it 1,000 species of bats? Neon tried to speed click it and he got it wrong. That's tough. You gotta take the risk sometimes, man. Okay. The correct answer is 1,450 species of bats. I hope that I'm gonna say this right. Susan said that every 1 in 5 mammal species is a bat because they're so diverse and there are so many species of bats. 190 people got that correct. Well done. I know the number questions can be kind of hard. But good job. Drumroll, please. Chat. Gwick. Gwick stayed in the lead the whole time. Messi got that one the fastest. Messi got a perfect score on that one. Damn. Gwick. You have won the quiz. What do you want? E-Rob sub. You got it, pal. Lamont. He's live, damn it. I hate when you guys do this. Put his name... Quick, does he have anything else in his name? Does he have a number or something? Can you put his name in chat so I give to the right one? Oh, it's 19. Oh, gosh. Wonderful.
There ain't nothing better. This dude said Culver's is better than Chick-fil-A. Are you stupid? This dude said...
We'll let E-Rob do his thing. Thank you for the... Max with the $5. This is one of the coolest ones yet. Thank you. And thank you for the $5. There's a little box for anonymous gifting. Oh my god. I know that people can gift anonymously. Why have I never thought about that? That's so stupid. Okay. You're right. Max, I agree. This was one of the better podcasts. I thought this was really, really fun and really, really interesting. I liked Susan a lot. We learned so much. I think we may have to have another bat podcast down the road. We should have a bat podcast on Honduran ghost bats specifically. Because look at these. Look at these. How sick are these? Yeah, we'll see. But that was really cool. That was that. Thank you. Thank you for the subs today. That was up there for one of the podcasts that I enjoyed the most. So thank you for being here for it. Twitch is absolutely an untapped reservoir for doing good. I cannot wrap my head around the fact that we raise at least $1,000 every week for charity. Every week! Like, it's insane. And to contribute to so many different conservation causes and to so many different species every week is crazy. There is a new YouTube video. You laugh, you leave. Go check it out. Danny edited the new video. We had to do it, chat. We had to. You have to. It's YouTube. We got it first. Let's go. Let's go. Thank you for the subs today. I know I don't always thank subs during the podcast, but I appreciate that you are subbing. Who is the guest tomorrow? Yeah, I feel like I can tell you. I don't think it really matters. The guest tomorrow is Cypher PK's wife, Manishi, I think is how you say her name. She's very nice, very cool. I'm really excited for her to come on. I don't have a time for you yet. Cypher PK is a Fortnite guy. They also live by us, so we've hung out with them before. Very nice. Very good people. They're the ones with the Australian Shepherds. They have 3 dogs, and they have a YouTube channel for them. Ring a bell? Anything? It'll be fun. So the podcast tomorrow night. I don't know what time the podcast is going to be at, but it'll be tomorrow night. Your upstream is distracting me a lot. I think I'm going to dye my hair tonight. Not me. I think I'm going to have Matt dye my hair tonight, which is a really bad idea. But I'm dyeing it darker, so you can't really mess it up. You just kind of have to cover it all in dye. It's just dyeing it darker. So I don't think that he can really mess it up. So I think I'm going to do that tonight on Matt's stream. So that's where you'll see me next. Then you'll see me Saturday for the Housewives podcast. Then you'll see me Monday for a desktop and PS4 because I got that PS4 bounty back, or they offered it again, and now the PS4 is set up, so we're doing that on Monday. And then Wednesday we'll do an IRL, and then there may be release streams in between. That red tail that came in with a broken wing has got his splint off, and he's in outdoor flight enclosure now and is doing really, really well, so he's going to be releasable, which is really good and really exciting. I'm really happy for him. So there's that for release. And then, yeah, I don't know that there's anything else that I have on my release radar currently. Oh, there is a Kestrel. I may release her Saturday. We had a Kestrel come in. I'll tell you tomorrow. This is the podcast. Actually, no, I'll tell you now because I already started talking about it. This family called in this wife called in and she said, we have a baby hawk and my husband has had it for 3 weeks and we've tried to put it outside, but it keeps coming back. And I don't want it in my house anymore. And I was like, what? can you bring it in? It's not a baby hawk. It's a Kestrel. And they've had it in their house for 3 weeks, feeding it ground beef only for 3 weeks. And somehow it's still alive. It looks like hell, but it's still alive. somehow. So she's at the center. She's in rehab, getting mice and quail and things like she should be eating. Ground beef is obviously, I don't understand. Like, I get that they eat meat, but I don't understand how you could in your head think this kestrel could eat beef. Like, it could kill a cow. Like, this is what it eats. You know, I just doesn't, you know, I don't know. But whatever. She's alive, so hopefully she'll be releasable within the next few days. That is hopefully something that I can do over the weekend. And yeah, I think that that's all the things that I have to tell you guys today. Go watch the new YouTube video, please. Commenting on it is very helpful. You can just say yo. Liking it is very helpful. Danny does a really good job, so go say nice things about Danny. And Bomb is doing pretty well. He's at the center. He's recovering. Nothing wrong. Danny's saying true to the comment thing. Nothing wrong with Bomb. He's just on kind of a slow recovery because both of his wings were broken. So I'll keep you guys posted on that. Teddy is wonderful. He has a brand new diet that took me like an hour to calculate. Calculated his BMR and kilocalories. I took like the calorie count off a yogurt container, off of eggs, off of the dog kibble. It is precise. So he is doing well. And I'm excited for you guys to meet him. I actually could bring him today to Matt's. Maybe I'll do that. Maybe I'll go grab him tonight, because I have to go to work tomorrow. It's my coworker's birthday tomorrow, so maybe I'll go get him today and bring him to Matt's tonight. So, yeah, maybe you'll meet him on here, on Matt's stream. I'll let you know. Let me see who I... Oops. S-band. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Nickelodeon. I will play the outro. I'm trying to figure out who I'm going to host first. I'm going to host Buddha. It's been a long time. I don't even remember the last time that I hosted Buddha. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to raid Buddha after this outro. But thank you for being here. Thank you for supporting the podcast. It means the world to me. I like it. Yeah, you guys already know. It means the world to me to be able to come on here and talk about conservation, and I just really, really appreciate seeing the same names show up every week and seeing new names show up and you guys helping them with, like, the commands and how to ask questions and how to donate and whatever. It's just, it's crazy. And I really, really appreciate it. I saw a clip this morning. I was looking through some old clips, and I saw a clip of Matt talking to me, and he's like, you get a podcast with 800 viewers of people that just want to learn. And I know that the number's not that different now, but it means so much to me that it's grown and that, like, it's improving in the graphics and everything. So thank you to my team, and thank you to you guys for allowing me to do this on the platform. It's a dream come true. I don't have a less corny way of saying it. Thank you guys. I will see you tonight on Matt's stream. I will see you tomorrow for the Housewives podcast. I'm very excited for that. So thank you for your donations. Thank you for everything. Peace. Exotics, what, 4 years ago or something like that? Working at zoos and getting internships and stuff like that. Then I fell in love with birds of prey at one of the zoos that I interned at.
One of the most popular streamers right now.
This is Jupiter. He's 8, barn owl.
That is insane.
Thank you
for donating.
Thank you.
I'm literally tearing up. Because,
alright,
this is not supposed to.
much.
It's an untapped reservoir for doing good. I will send you this cute thank you card. It has some names of some donators and some viewers on it.
That's awesome.
And I'll tweet this thank you.
We're super excited. Me too. That's awesome.
Those of you who donate, thank you so much. It means the world to me, and it means the world to those guests. It's still really important that you're here and that you're watching, and that's amazing also. I really need to learn when to start the raid. I think it needs to be a little before that part, but I started working in exotics,
what,
4 years ago or something like
some
that.
Point.
Working at zoos and getting internships and stuff like that.
Then I fell in love with birds of prey at one of the zoos that I interned at.
Right? Like, it doesn't really matter. This is why I like hosts better, because you don't have to time it. But I guess, is hosting is still broken? You can force the raid. Okay, bye. Thanks, guys.